Science with Knob Jokes.
Well, hello and welcome to our brand new episode of Science with Knob Jokes. I am, as ever, your majestically handsome host, Dr. Samuel Godfrey. And I am joined by the hazardous menace that is Daisy Eyre.
That's been my favourite so far.
Has it been?
I like to think of myself as quite a hazardous menace.
Look at that. It was a treat for you, really.
It was. That was the best one.
And you didn't raise any issue with me describing myself.
I thought I'd let it go because you described me in quite flattering terms this time.
That's very kind. So,
although you were wrong.
I've got nothing funny to say.
As ever.
Thanks, Daisy. Right, so for any new listeners to our podcast, welcome. Hi.
Hi there.
Hello.
God, how you look
doing?
Great today.
Are they new shoes?
You're very handsome.
Thanks, Daisy.
Not you.
I'm not going to cut that and put that elsewhere.
No, you're not.
Fit Science.
The first part of the show, as always, we kick off with some very exciting science, what I think is exciting, and Daisy decides whether she thinks it's hot or not. Basically, you rate the science.
That's what I do.
This first piece came from a recent tech conference, I forget which one. Developers from Microsoft Research Lab have created the Kane-troller, and this is a virtual reality device, but it's a white stick for blind people. So that rather than looking around, which they obviously can't, it provides haptic feedback based on how it's got like sensors and resistance. So as you tap your white stick about, it tells you where walls are and things.
That sounds really useful.
Which potentially can allow, say you had a job interview and you're going to be worried about getting there, you could go on, you could rehearse your journey through this with the cane, and you could get used to what everything would sound like and what it would feel like and where the curbs are and so on. And then presumably, as with everything, it'll then branch out into games and other things that people can
Less useful,
do.
But still fine.
But still, like, yeah, visually impaired people would enjoy a computer game as much as the next person. And
well, not if the next person was me, because I'd have no time for that.
No. No, you need imagination for a computer game.
And oh, wow. The worm has turned.
So, yeah, that was the first little rapid fire bit of
great. Yeah, I'm all for it. Cool. I was really prepared to hate that, because then everyone says, so I've got some tech. I'm like, oh my god, kill me. But no, I like that.
Yeah.
Do you know what? I'd go and speak to it in a bar.
Wow, you'd make the approach. Ballsy.
Yeah, why not, actually?
Yeah.
I mean, I don't know how far it'd go, but I'd definitely get a chat.
Cool. That's nice. That's resounding. From you.
Well, look, I just like to be decisive on these things because, you know, you've got to seize the moment, haven't you?
Next thing, there's a chemical called psilocybin, and this is the active ingredient in magic mushrooms. So it's the thing that makes people go hallucinating. And I remember when I was at uni, our university club went out into this sort of like square, and there was a pond next to it, and there was an oak tree which was growing this big old mushroom. And I remember this rather drunken person grabbing this massive toadstool and going,
no.
"I found magic mushrooms, guys! He wants to come back to mine." Could die. I don't think that's how.
I was
gonna say,
are they dead now?
I don't know. I never saw them again. But
guys, this is a PSA. Like, don't eat mushrooms you find in the grass.
What's PSA?
Public safety announcement.
I was thinking prostate-specific antigen.
No.
Okay, cool. But anyway, that's not what I was going to tell you about, was this guy, random guy. No, so psilocybin, there's been some evidence for a little while that it might be useful in treating depression, which is obviously useful.
And yes, that is useful. You're right. Well done.
So last year, some scientists in London, they looked at the effect of psilocybin on 19 people with depression, and what they did is they gave them two doses of psilocybin, and then they used MRI scanners to look at the brain activity. Now, MRI scanners are basically gigantic magnets.
I know what an MRI scanner is, Sam.
Fine.
God, you treat me like a child.
Is that something that...
M is for magnet.
Yeah. Okay. What they found is that when taking psilocybin, part of the brain called the amygdala, which is like a small almond shape in the brain, and it's involved in emotional response, in stress and in fear.
I don't think I've got one of them. I don't really have emotional responses.
No, or fear. Or you're like a honey badger. Just aggressive and take on a lion.
Just a robot, really.
Yeah, but it has its positives.
For most people, I'm sure it does.
It's when you just go and recharge in a corner and we get a bit of peace. It's lovely. And what? And then there's another area part of the brain which is also linked to depression. And when these patients took psilocybin, what they saw is activation in these two areas of the brain. And patients, when asked, said that they almost felt like they'd been rebooted, like being stuck in this deep, dark depression spiral. It kind of... One guy said it felt like he was a computer who'd been defragged. He suddenly felt free from it. And then they reported this afterglow from just two doses that lasted about 5 weeks. And interestingly, it seems to be the people they looked at were people who've got treatment-resistant depression, which is about a third of all people who've got depression have a type of depression where treatments don't work that well. And so off the back of this research, they're now launching a clinical trial in the UK testing this drug on 400 people to see if it might be a meaningful treatment for depression.
That's good, isn't it? Because I was going to say, 19 people is... I mean, it's a nice start, but it's not very impressive.
It's not that massive.
I could probably, you know, cheer 19 people at one go.
You couldn't.
I could.
No.
I'm a great laugh. but actually, if they're putting it into clinical trial, and that sounds quite promising, really, doesn't it?
Yeah.
So, presumably, they can make this artificially, not just... they just have to find a load of mushrooms and be like, guys...
The doses were like, they were given 25 milligrams of psilocybin. I don't think it was like,
here's this mushroom.
Here's an ounce of mushroom. Off you go. but and there was an important note to say that they advise people don't self-medicate magic mushrooms to treat depression, because the beauty of when you take medicine versus natural products is natural products have got all the crap in there still as well that could poison you, whereas the medicines have been refined to be pure and to be safe. So their thing was, don't do that, and certainly don't eat a toadstool from next to a
university pond. No, I'm not going to. You'll be pleased to hear. I think that's a very pretty bit of science. Yeah.
Yeah. Eye candy.
It's quite a looker.
Ooh. Mm. So fit science. That is the definition of fit science.
Yeah, it's nice.
Pwah. Brilliant.
I can tell it's really worked on itself.
Yeah, it's done its makeup.
Yeah. It's put some effort in.
Nice.
Yeah.
That's good. Now, we mentioned these in a podcast, I can't remember whether it was one or two ago.
There's been so many.
You didn't like them very much. So this is the Defence Advanced Research Projects Agency from the US, DARPA.
I can't even remember, I've scrubbed it from my memory.
Right, so they did the ones with the flowers that can listen to you.
I just had no time for this, yeah.
No.
I just, stupid.
Well, they've come out with something else, which is to be able to slow time on the battlefield. Okay. So
I mean, this doesn't even sound possible.
So yeah. They're not talking about the actual...
Is it like in a war movie where everyone goes... and they'll start running slowly?
For our listeners, Daisy just mimed slow motion running.
As I think you could all tell.
Yeah. It's like you paint a picture with your words. So they're not talking about... You're right. They're not talking about actual time, and so that American soldiers are suddenly running.
So you're telling me nobody's
quicker.
Found a way to slow time?
Not well. They have actually. Yes, we'll do a little segue. The closer you go to the speed of light, the slower time progresses. So if you take two paired atomic clocks, one on Earth and one, and this is to do with Einstein's theory of relativity, predicted this, and they've shown it in experiments. If you take an atomic clock, which is exceptionally accurate on Earth, and a paired atomic clock, and you put it up in a satellite, when you then look at them a few years later, the one in space is now slower than the one on the ground. Similarly, identical twins, one in space, one on the ground, the one in space will age less than the one on the ground.
Have they ever actually done that test?
Don't know about identical
twins.
They've
never done that test, have they?
No.
We're just guessing.
The atomic clock one they've done.
The twin one we haven't done, have we?
No, I don't think
so. That is pure speculation.
Yeah, you're right.
Yeah, I know.
So look. Clive looks wrinklier.
oh, look at his hair.
Yeah.
Grey.
Could it not be something the stress of launch? No.
No, that's for sure. He's just older.
But the theory is that the closer you get to the speed of light, at the speed of light, time pretty much stops. If you can travel faster. So if we were travelling to a star at a sizable fraction of the speed of light, it might take you 3 years to get to the star. But as far as people on Earth are concerned, it might be 50 years.
Interesting.
Yeah. So time is a thing, like light is a thing. And our brains aren't actually designed to be able to understand it.
Fucking deep, Sam. Time is a thing, like light is a thing. Everything is things.
When I'm quoted in years to come, my quotes are everywhere.
When it's on inspirational quotes over like a picture of some mountains.
Yeah, time is a thing.
Light is a thing.
Yeah. It's good. So they're not talking about that kind of time. They're talking about biological time. So certain insects and frogs and things in the tundra areas of the world, when it freezes over, they slow right down in hibernation in order to not die. And so they slow down all of their cellular processes. And this means that all the different molecules, all the different that constantly turning over and that are catalyzing one another, they arrest themselves to keep you in an almost kind of stasis. And then when it's applicable, they reignite and the organism comes back to life. And so what they're looking to do, so Dr. Tristan McClaw-Begley, who's the head of Biostasis Program.
That can't be a real name.
Hi, Tristan. Biostasis. Hey. So I just like the DARPA with a Biostasis Program. It's sounding very dark and
I know, this sounds like evil-y. Something you'd find in, like, I don't know, like
Marvel
film.
Yeah. But they're saying that if they can figure out how to halt these chemical reactions, how they can stop this catalyst, how to slow the molecular machines, and if they could do that on someone who's, say, been shot on the battlefield, you could potentially put them into stasis to get them back to hospital to preserve life.
Oh, I see. Yeah. Right, so it's not about slow motion running.
No, it's not.
Right.
No.
Although, that would also
they found
be cool.
a way of making American soldiers really slow in battle. It's not useful.
That would be so pointless.
It would be so pointless.
But, you know, more useful if you could make the enemy slow.
Yeah. Yeah, but then they would come
presumably
under,
you wouldn't make yourself slow.
And that would come under, like, chemical or biological warfare,
I mean,
which
I'm not
isn't
saying
allowed.
It's ethical.
Right.
Just useful.
Just useful. So their plan is basically to slow whole systems down. And it could also have other uses, like long-distance travel. Like, let's say we were travelling to other planets. Could you slow yourself down so that when you get there, you've not aged?
I reckon if that ever became possible, people would want to use that here. And, you know, that's, like, high-powered anti-aging, isn't it?
Yeah, it is. Because, I mean, they do this kind of, like, one of the ones which is, I suppose it's slightly similar, would be people that have brain trauma or huge, like, or their heart stopped for a while. They cool the body right down. So particularly if you've been unconscious for a long time,
yeah,
they cool the brain right down. And so I know a man, actually, who goes to the same pub that I do, who had a heart attack a few years ago. His heart was stopped for 20 minutes before the paramedics got there. And they basically put him into an induced hypothermic coma. And by being cooler, that allowed the brain chance to heal better, or it stopped the damage and allowed
That's
them
clever,
to limit
isn't it?
It. And you wouldn't know that he, he'd had this potentially brain-damaging incident. So anyway, what do you think of that? Biostasis.
Yes, I like it. I would also like it if they could do slow motion running. If they could do the dual effect of it.
The dual effect,
yeah.
Slow-mo running.
So slow-mo running and biostasis.
Brilliant.
I think you'd have the ultimate fighting machine.
That's great.
So people who, you know, could slow down the enemy and then never die.
So you want them to up their ambition, really?
Yeah. I think that's like superhero stuff we're talking about now.
I think it is.
And I think that's what we should all be aiming for.
There's the guy that's made the Tony Stark Iron Man type flying. Have you seen that on the internet?
I haven't, but I mean,
he's basically got these jet engines strapped to his hands and feet, and he lives in, like, Hampshire in the south of England or something, and there's a video of him flying across a reservoir, and he said he's had to get really quite buff in order to handle all the all of the stresses. But yeah, he's got, like, he's Iron Man nearly.
Oh, good luck to him.
So combine that with slow-mo and super healing.
And super healing?
You've actually got superheroes as a reality.
That's what I mean.
That's exciting, isn't it? I thought.
But as a first step, great. Love it.
Great. Love it. Wow. So DARPA, bit mixed bag for you.
Well, yeah. I mean, I think we've had success. I think we've had failure with DARPA.
Great.
I think they've really upped their game.
That's really nice.
Congrats.
Huh. Excellent. So our listeners won't know this, but I'm going to peer behind the curtain, ruin some of the magic now. We recorded the first four episodes before the first episode went out. We're now recording episodes once we've gone public.
Don't give all our secrets away,
right. We have had interactions from fans. and I thought I would like to address one or two of them. So the first one... actually, this is a friend of both of ours. It's a scientist from the Francis Crick Institute.
My God.
Called Martin Jones.
Hello, Martin.
Hi, Martin. He's Martin is an amazing scientist. He does he works with microscopes, and just to give people that aren't familiar with the world of electron microscopes a sort of sense of what they can do, if you took a cross section of a human hair, they can enlarge that cross section of the hair to bigger than the London Eye. If you've not seen the London Eye, it's massive, it's like 100 metres across. It's extraordinary, and then you can use that to sort of look and study cells and see how they behave. And Martin is one of the world's best people at building these kind of new microscopes and doing amazing stuff with them. And if I got that wrong, he's not going to complain because I bigged him up massively.
I mean, you've really sold well.
He is awesome. Anyway, he pointed out that in the very first pilot episode, you rated some science.
I did.
And you gave it a score of 7 ohms, I believe.
Which is, well, I did not know what I was doing.
So ohms are the unit of resistivity. Martin pointed out that as this is science with knob jokes, we missed an opportunity for an innuendo there because the unit of conductivity is the sort of the inverse ohm is called the Siemens. And he said that there was some kind of joke there. I don't get it. I'm not sure why that would be funny.
And that's why you don't do the jokes on this programme.
No, but thank you, Martin, for your contribution.
I also can't believe you initially described Martin as a fan. One of our fans.
One of our fans.
Martin.
Yeah, sure.
Sam's meaty story.
You know, tinnitus ringing in the ears.
I do.
Right.
I do.
I had no idea how many people were affected by it first.
How many?
Lots.
So we still have no idea.
I think the site I saw said 2 million Americans are affected by tinnitus.
Oh, God, that still gives me no real frame of reference, does it?
There's about 300 odd million Americans.
Do the math for me, Sam.
1 in 150.
Great, thank you.
You're welcome.
I mean, that could also be numbers you've just invented, but
I think that's about right. So 1 in 150 Americans have tinnitus. it's equivalent across the rest of the world, too, probably.
Why not?
And it's something where treating it is very difficult. Like, sometimes it goes. It's like it could be an inflammation of part of the ear, canal or something, and then it goes over time. But some people will be living with it for life. My mother-in-law has tinnitus that she just has to live with. And when it gets really bad, she has to listen to white noise to try and drown it out. And it really affect people mentally as well. I've seen friends who've got tinnitus who have become quite upset by the fact they've got this permanent ringing because they're now struggling to sleep. And it's not nice.
It must be utterly infuriating.
Absolutely, and more than infuriating because there's not necessarily any hope, and doctors can't do anything. Some people with tinnitus are able to control it to a degree. So, for example, if they stick out their tongue or bite their cheek or do some physical thing, it can alleviate symptoms. Mm. Now, there's a team at the University of Michigan who are coming up with something which may help some of these people. They are developing these little electrodes which get plugged onto their onto the back of their neck, and this stimulates a part of the brain which may be responsible for creating these phantom sounds that you hear, because they're not actually sounds, they're nerve signals in the brain sort of aberrantly stimulating.
Is that true in all cases then? So even if it's like an inflammation?
No, well, that's where it gets difficult, because if it's an inflammation, the nerves may well be getting a signal and then it might go in time. But for some people, it's a phantom signal. It's just part of the brain. In the same way that someone who's lost a leg may still feel an itch on their foot. Mm. And there's nothing they can do about it. But with this, what they've been able to do is try and sort of develop a treatment. And so for the control group, they didn't see any change in their tinnitus symptoms, but those that used the active device, they all reported a reduction in harshness or the decibel level of their symptoms, and some of them even said that the ringing had nearly disappeared over time.
That's great.
Which is really cool. And they need to obviously optimise the length of treatments, identify the people that this is going to be best for, because it won't work for everyone. They also need to see if they find ways of doing this for people who can't change it by like nodding their head or biting their cheek or haven't got that kind of trigger link to their tinnitus. But for 1 in 150 people, it's it's a potential real ray of hope.
Well, that's a nice thing, because I suppose you can't just go around sticking your tongue out, can you? Because that's not realistic as a way to live your life. So I suppose if there's something that can essentially replicate that same effect.
I mean, sticking your tongue out was an example. It's not like...
No, I'm running with it.
Okay.
That must be a lot more helpful in terms of living.
Yeah, and I don't know what the... whether it's curative, whether it sort of actually trains that part of the
brain. Actually, yeah, that's a... Is there a... like, are they working their way to a cure? Or is this just...
This is where it's early stages at the moment.
Oh,
so,
faster.
he looked angrily at the microphone. Faster, scientists. I know this is a new discovery, but faster.
I'm so sorry. I don't know why I'm so cross. I haven't even got tinnitus.
That's incredible.
I'm just a really angry young woman. Not even that young.
You're younger than me, though, I think, aren't you?
Yeah, everyone's younger than you.
I'm 79 this year. So, how would you rate that?
I think. Well, I mean, it's just a good thing, isn't it? There's no point being like, that's terrible.
So, do you want to give it a number?
Yeah, I'd like to give it a number. Right, bear in mind that I don't know the upper limit of any unit of measurement. So
I think you can usually assume there's probably not one.
There's no upper limit for any unit of measurement.
But there can be upper limits in your category. So, for example, you might say, I don't know, this circuit can handle 230 volts. So we know it can't go beyond that in our circuit that we're looking at. Or so you can impose your own upper limit.
The unit of measurement I'm going with is number joules.
Oh, okay.
Do I say it in the French way, joules?
I think
or
you
just
do.
Joules?
I
joules.
Think you have to, yeah.
Okay. Obviously, as everyone knows, there's 15 joules.
Yes.
That's as many as you have.
15, yeah. Yeah, in any given...
In any given time, in any you given have 15 time. Joules.
They come in packets of 15 or yeah. They and even if there's a lot more, actually what people don't realise is a subdivide into 15s.
Well, yeah, it's that you've bought 7 packets.
Even even though it's an SI unit and you'd expect it to work on the decimal system.
It doesn't.
It works on the 15s.
That's the magic of joules.
Wow.
I'm going to give that out of 15... A solid 11.
11 joules?
Yeah.
And is it losing 4 because they've not got further yet?
Because I just expected more somehow. I think, you know, as a first step, wonderful.
Wow.
But let's see what else we can do.
So hear that, Professor Susan Shaw from the University of Michigan.
I'm sure
Medical
School. Do you know what? I'm sure she's on the job.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Vote of confidence from Science and Objects there. And really, what more do you need in life?
Well, I mean... I'm a pretty great scientist, so I think everyone's after that endorsement, aren't they?
Yes. Cool. Right, now, I know it's a permanent thing that you don't like the knob joke element of
the show.
I
hate it.
So, I thought I'd try something slightly different this time, because someone direct messaged me a knob joke on Twitter.
Oh.
And I thought...
Who?
A guy called Simon.
Hi, Simon. Why did you do this?
And so I thought... I would read you this. It's a slightly longer knob joke. I'd read it out and then allow you to critically evaluate the knob joke, perhaps.
Right, Simon, are you ready for my critical evaluation of this joke?
So, a man goes to see a doctor who happens to be a friend of his. And whilst chatting, the doctor mentions that John Smith, who was a mutual acquaintance of theirs, sadly passed away. And the doctor says, "And I was performing the autopsy, and I have to tell you, John Smith had the largest penis I've ever seen." "Really?" said the man. "That may sound a bit weird, but I'd love to see that." So the doctor beckons the man through to the morgue, pulls out John Smith's body and says, "Take a look at that." And sure enough, it's a whopper. It's colossal. The man says, "Well, that's such a waste. I don't suppose you could maybe transplant that thing onto me, could you?" So the doctor agrees and does just that. That evening, the man goes home and says to his wife, "I've got a surprise for you," and he whips it out, and she bursts into tears and goes, "Oh my God, John Smith is dead!"
Right, so, a few thoughts.
Okay.
One.
Yeah.
What was really upsetting about that is that I had a real sense of impending dread all the way through.
But don't you have that with me anyway, most of the time?
Yes, I mean, that's just a side effect, spending a lot of time with you. But I really didn't feel good at any point in that process.
Okay.
It was a really sad time. I think the payoff wasn't quite worth all of the setup.
Right.
I think we could have got there faster.
Right.
There was a lot of, you know, preamble, wasn't there?
Yeah.
And I think... the punchline, as soon as the wife came on the scene, I knew what the punchline was going to be.
Right.
Having said that, I did laugh a little bit.
Okay. See, you had slightly different thoughts from me. I mean, my thoughts were, what doctor is the GP and also the pathologist?
I can tell you which doctor. Dr. Carl Kennedy of Neighbours.
So this should be rewritten as Dr. Carl Kennedy of
Neighbours. Yeah, he is every type of doctor, as we all know.
Wow. And then so he's able to do transplant. Yeah. There was no tissue matching to check there was no rejection of tissues.
Okay.
That bothered me a little bit. And just scant ethical agreement for any of this. I mean, this just seems like mutilating corpses. For,
well, clearly he's quite a renegade doctor.
He is a renegade. Well, Carl, classic Carl from Neighbours.
Classic Carl Kennedy.
Is he still on Neighbours?
I've got no idea.
No, me neither.
But I just remember that watching it, he was every type of doctor. So if you did an operation, Carl, you need a GP, Carl, you need a psychologist, Carl. He can help you out.
The other point I had as well was the wife's initial reaction as he whipped it out was, oh my God, John Smith's dead because this penis looks like that of John Smith, thus implying she had been unfaithful, right? But surely it should be, why have you got this horrendous Rankin penis that's got scars all over it and bandaged? And how has this happened? That would be the first thought.
I mean, I think there's going to be a divorce happening subsequent to this joke, isn't there?
Yeah.
But what I would say, Simon, is thank you for your time. If you've got any more, please do send them in.
Yeah, it's a joy to read them.
I won't listen again, but you send them in.
There we go. Well, I think that was a way of ending the podcast.
I mean, there's got to be one way of doing it, isn't there?
So thank you very much for listening.
Thanks.
It has been a joy. And speak to you again.
Bye.